Hey guys, Blaine from DTC Pod here, and I've got something you're gonna like. So if you're anything like us, bringing highly talented VAs or virtual assistants into your operations and workflows is a big part of running a business. But oftentimes the hardest part is sourcing and vetting talent, especially at an affordable rate. And that's where More Now comes in. They source and match you with top talent from the Philippines across finance, supply chain, operations, marketing, and whatever else you may need. And the best part is they're super cost-effective and back their talent with a 12-month guarantee. So go to morenow.co or check the link I'm dropping in the show notes to learn more about More Now and start offloading some of the most tedious tasks off your plate. We've had a bunch of success working with them and their VAs in our workflows, so excited for you guys to check them out. So before we kick off today's recording, I've got one more for you. Keeping up your momentum this year starts with the right selling tools. And if you're looking to increase revenue, grow faster, build more pipeline, and close more deals, check out the all-new Sales Hub from HubSpot. You'll be able to manage your whole sales process, plus my favorite part, the reporting. It's super intuitive, powerful, and customizable. Plus, the whole thing is powered by AI, so your teams can spend less time on tedious, time-consuming stuff and more time on developing relationships. Also, no one likes a clunky platform that takes months to onboard onto, but getting set up on Sales Hub is really quick and easy. It's free to get started, the pricing will scale with your business, and with more than 1,300 integrations and add-ons, you can tune it to your exact needs. Visit hubspot.com/sales to start selling with Sales Hub. What is up, DTC Pod? Today we're joined by Ben Acott, who is on the co-founding team of Feastables, and he also runs an agency called Magnetic, which works with cultivating some of the biggest brands and celebrity-led brands that you know of already and that you're going to know of as they continue to develop products. So Ben, I'll let you kick us off. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about your personal background and what kind of led you to the position that you're into today?
Yeah, man. Great to be here. Big fan of the pod already, so thanks for inviting me on. So a bit of background. I guess I'm a glutton for punishment with figuring out new product categories. I think I always wear the marketing hat no matter what I jump into, but it's really about just figuring out product that perhaps doesn't have a defined category. So had a social media agency that kind of predated Facebook. You know, we were fucking around with MySpace fan pages back in the day, and then started to pick up business with brands like McDonald's and BMW on the MySpace platform. So cut our teeth on social. I built that company up, pretty big back in the day, but just started to have this like hankering and pull for like what was back then like pre-DTC, figuring out like product and e-commerce and then subscription. Got poached by Facebook to be one of the first employees down here in Australia to figure out like what sort of like brand partnerships look like on the Facebook platform, just as ads manager and power editor and platforms like that was starting to be built out. Got bored pretty quickly of all the free barbecue and food at HQ, and ended up co-founding an e-commerce subscription business, which I then sold. And then just became obsessed with big brands and just like, how do you start to like, you know, sell and compel people to buy something they don't know that they necessarily want. It was around that time a buddy started a brand called Manscaped. So Paul Tran, really, really smart dude. It just told me, this shaver company he built up was dedicated on helping men shave their balls, and it was all built around humor and fun, and it wasn't yet a category. And I was just like, I'm in. It was, very, very smart team by that stage, but also, just completely obsessed by solving, product market fit through content, and then, obsession around testing. And it was just a very, very fun place to come into. So led that team, built that from a very early stage. What happened then? I think I started something, sold it, moved back to Australia, then got the phone call from Jimmy Donaldson's manager, Mr. Beast manager, saying, hey, Jimmy's going to build a chocolate factory. He wants to give it away. I think we've got a chocolate company here. Let's figure it out. So co-founded or jumped into the co-founding team there with Feastables before it was just a kind of idea stage. And they built a world-class team of operators like CPG vets. And we just built that brand up very, very quickly. So we launched that, I think, with about 6 months' notice, hand coding that theme, that Shopify theme, getting it ready for launch. Main channel video from Mr. Beast went live. We were down to the wire, like in terms of seconds to launch that. Launched it and it became one of the most iconic, well, you might have been one of the most iconic sort of brand launches. And that really kind of got my sort of toes in the water of, working with Gen Z, Gen Alpha. And then just the identification of, man, they don't know what the fuck they want. Let's figure out how to build it. And that's kind of ultimately why I left Feastables and built a venture studio called Magnetic. So Magnetic now is all about creating consumer brands that may not have a clear map or focus or purpose as yet, but we can solve that through content. So our approach to this is start with content first, build a product around that, and then align it with a creator or celebrity as a triple threat combo. So that's the initial thesis with Magnetic. We're hyper focused on content and creative. We're building a huge content facility here down here in Australia, dedicated to short format viral content that we can layer in brand execution into too. So that's the very short background of what we're building. So.
Yeah, I think it's so cool, especially like you're saying right now, having not only worked on the brand side, seeing what like creative performs and like a really high functioning team, transitioning over that, working with literally the biggest creator in the world and now spinning out a studio where you guys can kind of spin that out. But before we get too deep into the studio and how you guys think about building out content that scales as well as partnering it with the right, you know, celebrities, the right talent and the right operators, I'd love to get into, you know, some of the lessons that you learned at Manscaped. I think Manscaped, like you were alluding to earlier, is one of those brands that like really, it took a product that hadn't been innovated in a while and had like a really refreshing take on their marketing, messaging, their content, their copy, all of that sort of stuff. So I'd love if you could just share some of the learnings and lessons that, you know, you found while you guys were building up that brand.
Yeah, it was interesting. Like the initial thesis with Manscaped was there was a product and a category for every body part except for the man's balls. And so we knew that there was money there. We knew that there was a demand there. We dug a little bit deeper and realized that, you know, I think it was like 85% of dudes were already shaving or looking after their junk down there. But how are they doing it? So we dug into that. We did, you know, quite a lot of, you know, consumer research and just went out and asked them, like, you know, how are you doing? Turns out they were just stealing their wife or their girlfriend's razor blades, you know, in the shower and hacking away. So we kind of just solved, you know, that through old school kind of consumer tactics and research and very quickly built a product. And that's now a full suite of products. But I think the biggest thing that we kind of like hacked into early on was just like, how do we make this untaboo? Like, how do we make this like, you know, something that dudes actually want to become a part of and build a brand that actually forms connection? It's really boring subject, like shaving your balls. Like we would never talk about it if it wasn't done with how Manscaped actually solved it. So we just made it funny. We made it so the ads were engineered to go viral. One of the things we learned early on was that it was very difficult to find agency partners that would actually get that and understand and give it the level of thought that and the obsession that we were focused on giving the category. So, and so an example of that was the content framework that we built with that. Like we're known, Manscaped is known for the ads and creative early on and the big influencer partnerships. But how we got to that point was really interesting. There's, I think it was like a Monday morning, we would all, like the entire marketing team, and at this point, 95% of the team was marketing, jump in, jam out ideas, come out the other end with like one or two like content plays or creative ideas. Our producer team, like video production, like creative guys in that meeting as well, jamming out. On the other end of that, like on the output is just like one to two video ideas. And then they would then go shoot and then produce them midweek. And then by Friday, we would deploy them. And we would see what stuck organically. So we're looking for things like virality, organic reach, just engagement rates. And if there was performance there worth investing into, then we would then deploy like a proper production team to make it a higher end production. We would then back with media. So it was just this obsession around using content, finding what's stuck, and then backing the winners through proper production and making them so they can go on to a Hulu, then go on to a streaming service and then scale them from there. So, and that's really what gave us that culture and that edge, and then kind of ultimately what formed our retail partnerships as well with launching, you know, coming from DTC into retail play from there. The other thing was just like constant evolution. You know, I think, Manscaped sort of like funnel was like get them with humor, convert them with sophistication and hygiene and engineering and the right tool for the job. Like don't nick your balls, like, you know, trust us because we're the right ones. But early on, like it was a pretty tough game in terms of product development and engineering. We had a long way to go from where we started to, I think they're up to the lawnmower 5.0 now. But it was just like this constant evolution of engineering that kind of got us, you know, closer and closer to backing ourselves in to say, you know, Nick's safe, or, you know, we're not going to we won't let you cut your balls. It took a long way to get to that point. So that was a big evolution. The other funny thing is just, you know, figuring out and creating a thick skin for the crazy photos and images that our CX team were exposed to. You can only imagine, like, going from the early days of like, yo, you promised me I wouldn't nick my balls, but what's this? Like, you know, just like figuring out how we kind of get people through and teams through that just culturally. So a lot of fun early days. Now I think, you know, obviously category leader, one of the biggest sort of men's hygiene brands on the planet, and just still continuing to grow. Like I watch headcount continuing to grow, like new countries are launching. One of the few brands I think that hit profitability through 23, which is great. Just been a joy to watch as I sort of finished up with them a couple of years back.
So we're based in Miami, and I remember laying at the beach in Miami Beach, and I think I saw an ad of Manscaped passing right by, and it was something like, it was like a bold claim, like that bold question like that of like, have you shaved your balls or something like that? And it struck me because it's like, well, Gillette wouldn't do that. And it's just so interesting as well in terms of like the consumer behavior. Like you just mentioned previously, this thesis of like, how do you build products to make people buy something they don't necessarily want? And so, you know, a lot of people would have given up on this. Like, oh, there's already a solution. People are using their girlfriend's razors. And so can you expand into that? How do you extract that from the consumer to knowing, do they actually not want it in any possible way? Or is there a way that they do want it in? It just has to be packaged correctly and we just have to cut through the noise. And how do you go about doing that?
Yeah, so incredible question. It's kind of like a product now that we're building as part of Magnetic's validation engine to identify exactly what people do want before they know that they want it. And so we do that through a validation framework, and it's old school, you know, pre-launch testing where we, you know, load up mock products inside either ads or organic content, take them to a landing page, get them to sign up or, you know, enter in a credit card for a dollar, you know, which, you know, equates to like a pre-sale, and then just watch all the metrics that happen behind the scenes with that. So if you break it down to ads, landing page, email flows as part of this testing framework. On the ad side, we're looking for, you know, scroll stop or thumb scroll stop sort of, you know, rates. We're looking for rates between like 30-40% there. Is the product good enough and compelling enough to stop the scroll? And then what is the click-through rate? So if we're paying for this ad or this placement, what is the cost per click and what is the click-through rate of like creative? And then we're tracking the activity that happens on the landing page of just like heat map sensing and just like what's clicked, what's not. And then cost per lead, cost per email address, cost per text, things like that. What is the metric there? Which then helps us identify and start to predict like what is the intended CAC when we do eventually launch. So if we're like tracking super low on a cost per lead, we can start to then like forecast or at least kind of predict what a future CAC would be. But all of that then gives us like psychographic, demographic data. So then we're kind of validating market need, TAM, demographic, cost, and we can start to build out a proper model with that. And that's so freaking valuable.
And are these like mock-ups? Are these the actual product? Are these like 3D renderings? Or is it just a messaging and like a concept?
We will always take it through an art process. We usually spend like 2 to 3 days building out 3 or 4 different variants. So let's just say we start with a category, which could be, we know we want to get into personal care for teens, but we don't know where to start. Is it deodorant? Is it face care? Is it face moisturizer? Is it acne treatment? We usually start with the same brand, same name, same copy, but 4 different products. Throw that out there, see what sticks. Just say the winner or the banger there is deodorant, then we'll start to go into creative direction and sort of brand and product setup, and then create 4 different packaging alternates, 4 different landing page alternates, and just start to watch that whole thing sort of play out. As it gets down the line, we start to test name, formulation, call-outs, pricing, all the way through. So by the time it gets into looping in product and operations, we have a really well-baked product strategy, a marketing strategy. We have enough to build out a proper financial model with actually like validated assumptions in there, which then tells us, hey, is this something we want to start? Is this something we want to kill? Or is this something we want to partner with somebody else? Because it's just a lot bigger than what we think it's going to be. So,
yeah, I love that. There's so much to unpack there. And one thing that pops in my mind is, well, you know, when you got that call from Jimmy's manager, you know, with a creator that have so much pull and says, I want it done this way. We have to go fast. Did you like, you know, was this concept, this framework born after that experience? Do you lose control of your framework and process when working from someone that wants to move that fast?
Yeah, man. I've had so many late night conversations with like our then CEO, Jim, and also Jimmy. The answer is like the hard answer is we didn't get time to test shit with these. It was like, it was a grind. It was a sprint. You know, we launched that thing. I think I had like 3 days of no sleep. Like it was a hustle just to get it up out to market. What you're going to see now with Beastables, and I think it launched last week, is a complete reformulation and a rebrand. It was the company got big enough to take a breath and say, you know, is organic grass-fed the right approach? Does middle America or like West Coast, East Coast, like who wants this? I mean, and then how do they want it? Is the taste good enough? Like, do we actually have the capacity now to do proper research? I think Beastables team's like 90 full-time people, including an actual product team now where we can, you know, dig deeper into these numbers. The answer was, and Jimmy's main answer was that no, it needs to be generic. It should be a commodity that everybody can afford. So everybody gets to own a piece in Beastables. There's no restriction, be it location. So you can buy it anywhere in the country now. Everybody can afford it. And it's in a taste profile now that everybody loves. And what you'll see now is it's tied way deeper back into Mr. Beast's brand and his entity and what he's crafted and created. So had we have had time to test, we probably would have got to that ahead of a pre-launch. But, you know, alas, the pace of which, you know, Jimmy thinks and breathes and acts and wants things to happen, it's like, get it to market. I don't think it would have taken us long to get to them to the correct assumptions with Feastables, but, you know, making product, you know, formulation at that scale is very, very tough to get bang on first time. Do I think it's too early for a complete reformulation and rebrand? I think so. I think, you know, there's still a lot of market share and ownership of what they had and what we have had. And I think testing would have definitely fixed that. And I don't think the change is going to give the benefit that we probably would have expected. It's not going to be a 20, 30, 40% lift in revenue. It'll be like incremental 5, 6, 7%. But what it is now is tied back right back into Mr. Beast and Feastables as it is more of an integrated brand. So yeah, long answer, but yeah, no time to test that shit, Jimmy.
Yeah, and I think something that else that's important is like the framework that you just described, like there's a lot of creators in the world that are not Mr. Beast, right? Like when you're Mr. Beast and you have the most distribution out of like anyone in the world and you can create, like you obviously want to create a great, great product that checks all the boxes, but you've got that unfair advantage when it comes to distribution. So I think it's really neat to be able to approach like what you're saying, different creators and sizing up different markets and having that same framework to apply, because like not everyone is Mr. Beast and not everyone has that baked in distribution. Exactly. So on the heels of that, on the heels of that point, I'd love to know kind of like, tell us a little bit more about the studio, right? Like what types of creators are you guys working with? What types of operators are these like in-house brands that you're spinning up yourself? Like when you're like scouting the market for like opportunities, like what are you looking for?
All right. So massive question. There's probably a few answers. The first and foremost, we're building, I guess, a destination where talent management comes to us and says, hey, we think we have something here with product. We don't know what it is yet. Let's figure it out together. So we'll take them through that same framework to get like creator or celebrity product fit. Like what is the product? Does that creator or celebrity have the right to launch a product? And has that audience been tested to actually convert, to actually like pull out their credit card and buy something? That is a huge thing to wrap your head around. It's easy for like, you know, these smaller, and I wouldn't say smaller, but even like YouTube channels, like, you know, with 10, 20, you know, million subscribers, they still don't have that like loyalty to actually pull out their card and buy something. So we figure that out first through tests. The easy one there is merch, like spin up a one page, like, you know, start one product, merch line tied to a video or to a piece of content and just test and measure. When we get to that point, it's like, what is the category we're going after? So we'll then take a look at, we'll have conversations with partners at Walmart, Target, identify like, where can we start to think about like getting either, depending on the creator size, single digit market share initially, like where do we think we can pick up like 5 to 6 to 7% of like a, you know, $10 billion business? And what do we think we can add in terms of that? And where does the creator play in? Then we'll wrap them through that framework of like product market fit, testing, TAM, creative testing, all the way through. So we do start net new. We're talking now with if there was a Jimmy for every category, that's who we're going after right now. Definitely shooting for moonshots, $1 billion brands is kind of like the main thesis of what we're shooting things for. In saying that, we are looking still to roll up a number of DTC brands that have launched. What we're benefiting from right now is some beautiful brands, great products, really smart founders coming out the back of COVID and, you know, supply chain issues, really tough market conditions where we can then absorb them, align them with the celebrity and creator, and then relaunch or, you know, repartner from there, keeping the original founder in check on the cap table to enjoy the ride. But we come in and operate full stack with that. That's a really compelling business model that I'm a big fan of, just because there's some incredible products out there that are close to being killed off, which kills me just as a founder. So trying to create a safe space for that. But I think the bulk of what we do is net new. Like, my obsession now is just like, how do we solve Gen Z, Gen Alpha and their desires, both in terms of like content, trends, and then product? And so our whole like formulation with how and before we start is like, and this is something Jimmy told me, is like, think in thumbnail titles, like force and condense your idea down to like 5 words that are designed to get a click. Like, think about the thumbnail title. What is the title of the video? So Feastables was like, I built and gave away a chocolate factory. Like, fuck. Of course that's going to be a bang out. Like, it's just Mr. Beast doing like Willy Wonka, like no shit. So that taught us to think about that. So as we think about, you know, scaling that down a little bit to sort of mid-tier the creators, how do we sort of like integrate with their creative, their strategy, and how do we use the product and the category to enable them to produce content they normally wouldn't, like it just wouldn't work otherwise. So it's like thinking about content first, product second, and then just this mishmash of like how to kind of make it all kind of stick. Like that. So there's a few different ways that we're approaching it, but deep in exploration and, you know, we are incubating or launching 3 products right now. 2 will likely make it. 1 is our validation engine, that we will eventually start to bring into other, you know, other creators, other people, other, you know, innovation teams to use and to validate.
I mean, there are like variables that you can control to make these partnerships work. And then there's like the variables that are totally out of your control, right? Like if you're going after the Mr. Beast of every vertical, Mr. Beast also has a talent for business and an understanding of business. And I'm curious on what is the difference between the two approaches, which is A, you either package it up and find the right creator and propose it, or the creator comes at you with the idea. Which of those two dynamics is best? Do you stick to one? Because if the creator knows nothing about business and product manufacturing and everything, I could see how if it's the creator's idea, it could be a bigger challenge. I'm curious if that's right or wrong.
Dude, great question, man. I think we're talking to, and it's locked down with NDA, so look, I can't say who, but we're talking with one of the world's biggest athletes right now. He's like, change the game. As big as it gets, he's not native to business, to producing content and all the things that are important to us and what we're looking for a co-founder. And so it's a challenge there. We've got like one of the most recognizable faces in the world, but just doesn't have that passion business now. So even like really like that comfortability of like, you know, doing short format content or proper big production stuff. He's done, you know, big multi-million dollar deals like with like sponsorships, but never really owned the narrative. You know, on Jimmy's side, though, you know, he started out as a 14-year-old kid that had knew nothing about business, but he obsessed over learning. And now he's like, you know, I think at 23, he just like completely dedicated like a huge chunk of time of like figuring out business as it related to CPG, as it related to chocolate, and just wrapped his head around that because he had guys like me and Jim Murray, like smart dudes in CPG that could advise him, but he wanted to see things from his perspective and do it his way, which is completely fucking different to anyone else's on the planet. In such a great way. He had that dedication and obsession over figuring it out. What we look for though is like, how do we then, part of our job is to take these people, those profiles and build them up so they are an authority as a CEO, as a co-founder, as a business person. As we think about this other athlete, you know, life after their sporting career, how do we start thinking about legacy for them? Like what are the things that are important to them? And how do we position that so it's authentic and they're not just coming across as like another cheap creator brand launching into market? That's the shit we're trying to stay really clear of. It's not just like a paid endorsement where a creator's holding a product and smiling. That ain't what we're looking for. It's like deep within the content, deep within the DNA that made them, you know, popular in the first place, bringing that out into product and then making them feel confident to go on the front cover of Forbes magazine and do an interview. You know, like with Jimmy's Forbes interview, like, I was there with him and just, you know, it was just like, yo, Ben, is that right? Am I making this up or is that correct? Like, you know, just like, you know, so it was just like creating a safe place. And he, you know, and he would have done great without me, but just making sure that he knew his shit. And, you know, I gave him that support as it related to like building up his profile in business separately. So it ain't just about launching and scaling a product. It's about like owning the narrative and finding out like how we package them up from being a dude that gives away chocolate factories and crazy content to actually being a smart dude and being perceived by the press and the media. And you know, his community is a really smart businessman. So Jimmy already is all of that stuff long before we came along. But he is the exception to almost all the people we're talking to.
Ben, one question that I have that's, I guess it's moving slightly in a separate direction, but a lot of brand founders and operators, they kind of like to your earlier point, they think about like partnering up with creators. Actually, one episode that we just, I just interviewed the founder of this brand last week, Nicholas from this brand, Matena, they were kind of like what you were talking about. They've been around for about 5 years. They were selling in the Canada market. And then all of a sudden they partnered up with Andrew Huberman and are launching like big time in the US and now are really going to scale, right? So I think this is like a very interesting model in terms of like combining a product with a celeb, whether it's at inception or even if the business has a little bit of traction.
Blaine, one thing, I'm sorry to jump in there.
Get in there.
But like something I find really interesting is like talking about these, you know, one thing we haven't talked about is like the negotiation and compensation structure, especially when like the company has already existed versus like at inception. It's a very different conversation to have. I'm also very curious on that. Wanted to make a note on that, but Lane, I just found that interesting that they'd already been going for 4 years. I bet that negotiation conversation is very different than like if they were conceptualizing it.
Well, yeah, let's go there, Ben. Like, what does it look like? You mentioned that these are some opportunities that you're kind of looking toward, being able to tap into companies that already have an existing ecosystem and framework, partner up with a creator to throw some jet fuel on it. Like, what does a deal like that look like?
Our standard deal terms are 40-40-20 as a templated like term sheet that goes out, and that's the start of a negotiation. It's obviously highly dependent on like, you know, what expectations are, but 40 to us, 40 to them, 20 for the companies as we start to build out stock. Executive team, and then just future raising requirements for it to get them through to a Series A. So that's kind of like how we start to think about initial structure. It really does depend, though. You know, we need to know, like, does this celebrity creator have a vision to lean in outside of just, you know, filming content once a month? Like, because ideally that's what we're looking for. Like, they know their audience and their market better than us. We need to dig really deep into that, like extrapolate and let them kind of, you know, bring that out. We want them producing their own on the fly content, like, you know, dominating their own social, you know, integrating into their own content, into their own appearances, whatever it looks like. So that's the expectation when we look at a 40-40-20 type deal. Existing brands, our approach to that is like full roll up. So we effectively go out and acquire a brand, usually within that kind of like 3 to 5 million revenue, probably a down year last year is kind of what we hope to see. But, you know, coming out of the gate strong with great loyal customers initially, full acquisition, and then we kind of bolt on it. It's not too dissimilar still with that 40-40-20 split. Again, on the creator side, it depends on depth, engagement, follow account, things like that. And then also then like big vision, like how big do we think we can make this thing? If we know that, you know, because what we see is like so many great DDC brands just flop on the content side. It's just the shit that's just so hard to solve. It's just not native to many people. That's what we do best. We have like full content production in-house, big facility. We can launch and deploy content within, you know, very, very quick succession, and it's fluid to us. So we look for brands that just like flop in that, but just would scream out like viral content. Like, how do we create proper viral content and throw fire at it with a celebrity and then scale up from there? So, but yeah, it always kind of comes back to that initial 40-40-20 to us.
We are really excited to announce that DTC Pod is officially part of the HubSpot Podcast Network. The HubSpot Podcast Network is the audio destination for business professionals, and we're really excited about being part of the network because we're going to be able to keep growing the show, bringing you guys amazing guests, and obviously helping you guys learn from the best founders, marketers, and builders of the most successful consumer brands. So anyway, keep listening to DTC Pod and more shows like us on the HubSpot Podcast Network at hubspot.com/podcastnetwork. And I like how you guys are thinking about the types of creators you're partnering with, right? Like, there's big celebrity, but then having a celebrity who's like really content minded is different from someone who might be famous and might like show up for a photo shoot here and there for like a really big brand, but like isn't actually like a creator first. Whereas like Jimmy is like, he's a creator first. So like he's constantly churning out content that he can feature stuff in. He can talk about it. He can talk to audiences. So I think it's also neat that as you guys pursue that, with content being a core pillar, knowing that like you also want a creator who's going to be able to speak to the brand and really align with it, as opposed to just like, oh, big celebrity, like one of a bunch of endorsements, and maybe they take one photo op and that's it, right?
Exactly, man. It was funny though, with Feastables early on, we had to earn Jimmy. And it was frustrating early on because we'd built Feastables, Mr. Beast Bar, chocolate, you know, it was all around him. So we launched, I think it was Escape Room Video. We launched Feastables, right? We came out the gate, sold 10 million bars in world record time. It was incredible. But then like Jimmy didn't really lean in for that first 6 months. I think like, I'm pretty sure he said something like, yo, I'll get to 100 million in revenue and then I'll take a deeper look at it, or something like stupid like that. It was like a stupid revenue. And I'm like, fuck, like we built this whole model to like not lean on paid. Like not to like even touch like, you know, Meta for our acquire. We actually ended up having to do it. But what we did is we earned the right to get more Jimmy time. And I think that time will still be consistent. If we're looking at, super high net worth celebrities, they will do what they do best and how they, you know, and in a method that they know. We need to earn the right, usually through revenue or through hopefully creating a compelling enough product or value proposition to get their time. I don't think we're ever going to get it out of the gate. So, Jimmy eventually turned around at 6 months. We're like, okay, we'll do some short format TikToks and I'll put it on the Mr. Beast channel rather than just the Feastables channel. So we heard that. And now he's leaning in pretty hard. So that's for context. But yeah, you kind of earn that. You build that relationship, you build the trust, you build the thing that kind of, eventually sort of becomes part of the brand with that integration.
So when it comes to a partnership like the one, say, with Pete Davidson with Manscaped, where he's not like a co-founder of the brand, how do you measure? Also, he's not like a creator per se. He's not a content creator first, unless you count comedy as content creation. But there's not as much data to measure how big of a risk is this. Like, sure, it's going to be a hit in terms of brand, because the timing was right and all that stuff with Kim K, etc. But like, how do you measure and how do you go about those deals to de-risk and evaluate whether this is a worthy investment for a company like Manscaped?
So Pete invested. I think at a certain point, there's gut feel as marketers,
right? He invested. And Pete,
yeah.
Got it.
But there's certain profiles that you know as a marketer, as a founder, that's just going to crush for your brand. And Pete ticks every fucking box. Like, girls love him. Like, guys love him. He's just funny as fuck. And with our humor focus, it was just like the perfect match. Like, I still don't think we really find anyone that's more suitable. I think we just got to nail the frequency with that guy a little bit more. But I don't think there's a real valid way of, like, you know, you can definitely go out and like fictitiously put together like, mock Pete up in an ad and just see how it hits in terms of like that same engagement test and, you know, things like that. But there's just bangers that, you know, like as a, you know, with gut feel, and that's at that scale. Further down the line, like, you know, we are testing five different creator groups, you know, all like 5 to 10 million subscribers that have tested conversion in the past. That we're testing, like, who is the right fit for our new teen tween personal care brand. And we are testing that. They're testing the shit out of that. They know what's happening. We've had approvals from their talent management, from their management, to say, hey, we're going to put this creative into this ad placement with this product, and it's going to be net new people. This is the demographic that the ad's going to be served to. Limited test of like 150,000 reach frequency of one, and we're just going to see like what hits best. So there's a very quick way of validating like who is a good creator. For founders like wanting to know like who do I partner with, like we're going through that now with one of my brands, Drink Monday. It's a non-alcoholic spirits brand. we're just testing to see, like, is celebrity the right play here? Like, every fucking celebrity's done ARC or non-ARC. Like, is it the right fit? So we're just, like, you know, we've gone rogue. We've just, like, found 10 celebrities, photoshopped them into an ad creative and let it run on paid, and we're just fucking around with seeing how it goes.
Yeah, yeah. And then I mean, it's funny because, like, I'm asking you these questions of analytical, et cetera, and you're like, I just know in my gut. Like, I have experience doing this, and you are one of the world's best when it comes to this stuff, and you have experience, right? You're confident in your assessment. And if you know there's probably not a better fit of a person, there likely isn't. And so it's a risk worth the gamble. So in terms of getting more analytical, I'm sure you might do in your content studio. So I would love to dive into your content studio. What is the thesis around having your own content studio? And what are you guys, like, actively working on there on a day-to-day basis?
So it's being built super early stage, but my obsession over Gen Alpha, Gen Z, and the testing framework that we're building with Magnetic doesn't really fly with paint. They're not on Meta. They are on TikTok, but they're reacting to organic content. And so if we start to form hypotheses around, like, okay, personal care, it's deodorant, we will physically mock our product and shoot a shit ton of content around that very, very easily. We have talent. We have, you know, our studio has a kitchen, bathroom, bedroom, like, it's ready to go, lighting all set up. We're just producing like a month's worth of content in a morning and then just testing through organic. What we're doing at the moment now is setting up a, excuse the background noise here too, guys, if you can hear that. We are testing this or that. So created a TikTok specifically tied to this or that. And so we would tie in existing products, like, you know, something stupid like fucking Snickers versus, like, you know, chocolate bar, this or that. And then when we bring in our own products, this or that, we're using that exact same thing. So the channel, the platform is known for, you know, user selection, and we're building up a ritual or a habitual use case for just selecting this or that and just using it as simple as that. The other big thing we're going deep into, and this is slightly a dark area, is using Snap and using like classroom group threads and then infiltrating one student in each channel and then having them lead and ask the, you know, A, B, or C. So we're putting in like 3 deodorant products, like mock-ups, and asking those group channels at scale. We're talking like tens of thousands of kids that we're exposed to now, just asking them in platforms that they're native to. So things like free to us, where we're paying kids on a monthly just to, like, you know, infiltrate their own group chats and go from there. So kind of rogue, kind of dark, probably, you know, not something we talk about too much apart from in this pod, but, you know, that's how we approach and think about content.
Yeah, I think that's so spot on, especially the last part about being native where the customers are. My last question for you, Ben, was going to be around... as you think about, like, developing products, right? You've got different creators, you've got different niches, you've got different audiences. What type of, are there any product categories that you get, like, super excited about that you're like, this is just something that I want to build and I need to find the right creator for this? And is there anything that you, like, really don't want to touch just because you're like, that is, like, a type of, like, nightmare that I just don't want to get involved in? Like, what type of products, like, really excite you as you explore content and creators?
Oh, man, I think I've just got this unhealthy obsession with boring product categories that you can fix with content and making it cool. Again, like, you take a boring subject or a boring product and then start with content, it makes anything fun. Dude, we're looking at fucking anything from, like, making pickles cool, like, actually going deep into creating a fucking pickle brand. It's, like, popping at the moment. But making, like, just boring stuff like that. Deodorant commodity products that people are using day-to-day. So that's the other obsession. Like, if we can get into, like, a day-to-day ritual and form, like, habitual use cases and loyalty to a brand. So it becomes like, it gets a consumer to the point, well, why would I buy an Axe body spray when I have this product here that talks and speaks and produces content and has, like, you know, carnival spectacle moments tied to it? Why the fuck would I buy these boring brands? So that's kind of the healthy, unhealthy obsession with boring. And I think that's kind of the thing. We're looking at, you know, taking market share in retail is probably where we'd like to end up. We get there through DTC, through the testing framework, and build initial loyalty and instantaneous, like, purchase through DTC and Amazon. But it's really, you know, big grand scale retail is the objective. So it has to then fit in a Walmart or a Target or a grocery store. So
yeah, and no, I was just gonna say, and I really loved your point, and I just wanted to, like, bring it up again before I forgot. But, like, we hear a lot of times people saying, you know, take organic and see what works and then run it on the ad side of things. I think at the scale that you guys are thinking, and for brands that are looking to like get beyond, you know, 8 to 9 figures, like I love that framework of taking creative that wins and then going and like with us on the studio side, like really blowing it up, because like then you get advantage when you've already like tested and validated, you know, bigger budget creative, which is something a lot of people think about and don't really, you know, maybe won't take the right swing at. So Ben, as we kind of wrap up here, I'd love to know, where can our audience connect with you? Where can they find more about Magnetic, and where can we find you on socials?
So I'm pretty stealth. I kind of go under the radar a little bit. I've just started to mess with Twitter. I'm Ben Acott 3T, so Ben Acott TTT. There, I'm on LinkedIn, probably most active there. Magnetic.co is where our home is going to be. We just finished up design of the most fucked up website I've ever built and can't wait to deploy that. It's exactly unexpected. Our whole mantra is an unconventional venture studio, and you'll see that in the next week or so. And I think that's it. I tend to try to fly under the radar, like the products and the brands, and then the people that we partner with speak for me. So that's kind of my style.
Well, sweet. This was a bunch of fun. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks for having me. Have a great day.
Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you enjoyed this episode of DTC Pod. If you enjoyed the show, we'd love your support. A rating and a review would go a long way as we continue to host the best builders in DTC and beyond. Follow and subscribe to the show, and make sure to check out our show notes where you can find our socials and weekly newsletter. Visit us on dtcpod.com to join our founder community and access resources from every episode. We'll see you on the next pod.